Welcome to a Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Scott Burton. It's Tuesday, May 22nd, 2018. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we'll find out how you can support marine mammal research and education by watching whales. State government reporter Andrew Kitchenman will summarize this year's legislative session for us, and we'll learn about science, technology, engineering, and math-focused summer camps for kids. Those interviews, National Native News, Bird Note Music, and more right here live and local on a Juno Afternoon. Currently 53 degrees and rainy here in the capital city.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonio Gonzalez. The governor of Oregon issued a statement Monday affirming tribal sovereignty. In a written statement, Governor Kate Brown said she rejects any suggestion from the federal government that tribes are racial groups rather than sovereign nations. The stance comes in reaction to statements from the Trump administration in January that the federal government would allow states to add work requirements for Medicaid services for tribes. Brown said, quote, "The federal government's recent stance toward our tribal nations disregards and disrespects the unique and longstanding legal status of Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes as sovereign governments." She calls the administration's actions to pursue the work requirements legally unsound. Last month, some U.S. senators warned the Trump administration against removing tribal exemptions, pointing out that Medicaid services half of the patients at some tribally operated health systems and about 40% of patients at Indian Health Service facilities. The Nez Perce tribe is joining the growing list of those pharmaceutical companies over the effects of opioid addiction linked to prescription drugs. The Idaho Statesman reports the tribe is taking on more than a dozen opioid manufacturers for what the suit says is racketeering, negligence, and public nuisance. The complaint says opioids harm the tribe's ability to maintain its culture and sovereignty for future generations. At least 600 government entities, including tribes, have filed suit against pharmaceutical manufacturers and distributors. A federal judge in Cleveland, Ohio, is overseeing the suits and held an open court session earlier this month. A lawyer representing several tribes pushed to have tribes placed on their own legal track, saying tribes are especially hard hit by the opioid epidemic. A new documentary is looking at indigenous people's response to the Me Too movement. The documentary is part of a launch of Rematriation magazine. Sol Traverso reports.
The Me Too movement is a national effort focused on exposing sexual harassment and violence. A half-hour documentary by Rematriation magazine tells stories of empowerment by Indigenous women. The producer of the film, Michelle Shenandoah, says that she and others in the film have been focusing on community outreach to teach traditional cultural practices and values to young people.
What are our teachings? What are our traditions? What do we have that's available to us to begin to find healing, that we can do it, we can find healing, and then begin to shape, you know, how we move forward together in that healthy space.
Shenandoah also places emphasis on generational trauma experienced by men as a factor of abuse. Co-producer Neil Palace, who is also featured in the film, talks about the trouble that occurs among groups of men.
Sometimes that larger group has a tendency to numb that voice, to stand up for the women.
Rematriation magazine aims to launch its first publication this summer. The film is being offered on different online platforms. For National Native News, I'm Sol Traverso.
Wyoming officials are scheduled to decide this week whether to offer the nation's first grizzly bear hunting season outside of Alaska since the mid-70s. The federal government removed endangered species list protections for grizzlies in some areas last year. Tribes and environmental organizations filed suit to stop the Wyoming hunting season, claiming a lack of consultation and worries that the bear's recovery is not solid enough to sustain hunting. An Oregon judge has ordered a 15-year-old to apologize to the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs for starting a fire last September that destroyed almost 50,000 acres. The teen is also ordered to pay some $36 million in restitution, a sum the court acknowledges he is unable to pay. The Oregonian reports the juvenile is also ordered to apologize to the U.S. Forest Service, the Oregon State Parks Department, and the city of Cascade Locks, among other entities. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Quantic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, moving our economy for over 165 years. Our vision is to operate injury and accident-free with safety programs, training, and technology. More at bnsf.com/tribal relations. Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills. With rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
And you're listening to A June Afternoon here on Tuesday, May 22nd, 2018. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 6 minutes after the hour. Joining me in the studio now is Allie Schuler and also Valentina Malika. They are both grad students with the UAS School of Fisheries, and we're here to talk about the Alaska Society for Marine Mammalogy student chapter and also a whale watch that's happening this Friday, a very unique whale watch that's happening this Friday. Allie and Valentina, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us. Yeah,
it's nice to have you here. So I guess we should start with the Alaska Society for Marine Mammalogy student chapter.
Yes.
What is it, Allie?
So the Society for Marine Mammalogy is an international chapter of students, researchers, naturalists, and more. It's a renowned organization that publishes a journal, and we are a student chapter that essentially supports marine mammal research within the state of Alaska, kind of emphasizing collaboration within our many different divisions all throughout the state, you know, from here, from Juneau to Fairbanks, Bethel, and more, Homer, Sitka.
Fairbanks, and yeah, we have people from all over Alaska that are part of this chapter.
Yourselves included?
Yeah, ourselves included, yep.
Okay, you're both grad students. Valentina, you're working on your PhD. What are you studying?
I study blue whales, so I'm looking at their physiology, I'm looking at their reproduction and their stress response by analyzing their hormones in their fat layer, so...
Okay. Yep. Allie, you're working on your master's. How about you?
Yes. So I'm studying humpback whales, specifically our local Juneau humpback whales and how they respond to whale watch vessels and also the conservation benefits of whale watching here in Juneau.
Okay. So you two and many of your colleagues, fellow students, instructors, I imagine, are going to be on this whale watch cruise this Friday.
Yes, sir. So in addition to us, we will also have representation because we do have so many different students spread all throughout the state, and summer is a busy time for especially field work. We will have displays also showing research from some of our classmates that are doing research in Antarctica on Weddell seals, fur seals in the Pribilof Islands.
We have walruses and sperm whales. We will have contribution for everybody, but we also have two of our faculty members that are our long-term professor here, University of Alaska Fairbanks and University of Alaska Southeast, and works on marine mammals. And we do have a very special guest.
So in addition to our representatives from the University of Alaska, we are lucky to have Jenny Draz Palmer, who will be featured at our whale watch. And she is especially an important aspect because she began researching whales 50 years ago in Southeast Alaska. And a lot of what her and her husband researched is pretty much the foundation to marine mammal research, specifically with humpbacks in our area. They established using the backside of flukes to identify humpback whales and coined the term bubble net feeding. Bubble net feeding is when the humpback whales will corral a school of fish using a net of bubbles. And once they have come into a tight ball, we'll herd them all up to the surface with their mouths and take big gulps at the surface. And these are things that we just take for granted here in Juneau as common knowledge, but they really set the foundation for what main marine mammal research in Alaska is.
And you mentioned the prints on the back of the whales. It's almost like a fingerprint for them, right, identification-wise?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a unique pattern of shapes and colors, black and white, that allows us to identify each whale singularly. It's exactly like a fingerprint.
Valentina, go ahead.
Oh, and I was going to say, so they, using this fingerprint, they were able to establish this Hawaii-Alaska connection that the whales that are coming up to Alaska are also going down to Hawaii, where they calve and they breed.
Speaking of whales in Hawaii, did you bring a few sounds for us?
Yes, so I've been lucky to work in both Alaska and Hawaii studying humpback whales, and so I brought a little tidbit to give you a little bit of an acoustic rendition of some of these whales.
All right, go for it. Okay.
Is it working?
Here we go. So, Allie, tell us what we were just listening to.
Yeah, so it's the male whales in the Hawaiian waters that are singing this song, and they'll sing it all throughout the wintertime. It's thought to be associated with mating, but we do sometimes hear it in Alaska. But it's a pretty amazing. You can be in the water in Hawaii, and you can hear it echoing all throughout the area. So these are essentially this song that's sung during the mating time in Hawaii.
All right. Why marine mammals, you two? Why is it important to you, Valentina?
Well, they are fascinating animals. I mean, they are mammals like us, but they live underwater. So that's a unique characteristic of them. And they also are top predators. They're basically the end of the food chain. So everything that is happening below in every levels, the levels of invertebrates, krills, algae, then will relate and will affect them. So they're very important ecosystem sentinels as well.
Allie, what drew you to this field?
I think that exactly the last point that Valentina said, that whales really are ecosystem sentinels. So we can tell a lot about the health of our oceans based off of the health of the whale populations and even how we interact with the environment. A lot of my research is determining how are we influencing humpback whales and how are these whale watch experiences potentially having a positive impact on people. And especially a place like Juneau, where whale watching is a really important industry, to keep it as a healthy industry to benefit not only the whales themselves, but people too, is really important. And we feel a deep connection with these animals. They're the charismatic megafauna that we feel this deep connection with that sometimes is one of the deepest connections people have with nature. And it is really important to protect them.
Valentina, you said whales will be part of the tour on Friday, but you're going to be talking about all kinds of mammals, right?
Yeah, so we will have contributions, and we will talk about a large variety of marine mammals. We're going to talk about harbor seals that are very commonly found here, as well as sea lions, but stellar sea lions. We have some contribution about walruses that are pretty interesting animals, and also we will talk about sperm whales. We'll cover a variety of marine mammals that are found here and in other areas as well.
I have this image of a bunch of scientists like you all over the boat, and anybody you want to talk to is going to have something interesting to say.
I think that's what's really unique about this whale watch compared to any other whale watch you could probably go on this summer, is that you're going to have the opportunity to talk with people that not only has been doing whale research since the beginning of whale research, but what is the most up-and-coming and cutting-edge research that's happening, technology that's being used, and not only learn about it, but be able to contribute to the continued education of students, not only now, but in the future, to really improve the overall quality of education, outreach, and research.
Okay. Can you give us the details again on how to get tickets for this Friday's whale watching and marine mammal watching trip?
Yeah. So we have a website. It's on brownpapertickets.com. So if you go to www.smmakstudent.brownpapertickets.com, You can purchase tickets that way and learn more about our chapter, get a link to our website to get even more information about the different research we have going on within our chapter.
We also have a Facebook event. Just type Alaska Student Chapter Whale Watching Fundraiser, and you'll find a Facebook event as well for that with all those details.
Okay, and what is the website again once more?
So it's smmakstudent.brownpapertickets.com.
And that's Society for Marine Mammalogy Student Chapter mm-hmm. in short. Or find your event on Facebook and search for what one more time?
Alaska Student Chapter Whale Watch Fundraiser.
All right. Ali Schuler, Valentina Malika, it's been so nice to have you on the show today. Did I get your name right?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Are you sure? Is there anything else that either of you would like to add?
I think that this
come join us. Yeah. It's going to be great. It's going to be fun. There's going to be a lot of interesting talks, and we're going to have some foods, and we're going to have a great guest speaker, and maybe some prizes. So there's going to be a lot of things happening. It's going to be fun.
And
join us.
Like she said, refreshments will be available. We will have a cash bar and great people there. So it's going to be a lot of fun, and we'd love to have you there.
6 to 8 this Friday night.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, you too.
Thank you.
Never look back, never look back, never look back, never look back. Hi, this is Lauren with Juneau Parks and Recreation. Splash into summer with Juneau Pools. Take advantage of our new $129 summer swim pass for all ages, providing admission for lap and open swims, tot time, channel walking, water fitness classes, and more. Valid May 1st through October 1st. Remember, head over to Augustus Brown during Diamond Park's annual closure, May 6th through 22nd, and enjoy Friday night moonlight swim. Visit us at JunoPools.org and like us on Facebook.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, May 22nd, 2018. It's about 20 minutes past the hour. And joining me in the studio now is one of my colleagues, state government reporter Andrew Kitchenman, who works for both KTOO and Alaska Public Media. He's been covering the legislature this year and last year. And I thought as the dust settles here from this, was it the 30th session, Andrew?
Yes, it's the 30th legislature.
I thought that maybe we should just sort of take a recap and figure out what happened this year. So anyway, welcome to the show, Andrew. It's nice to have you here.
I'm glad to be here, Scott.
Okay, so let's see. Recapping, from January, we went how many days this year?
About 117 or 118. It depends on if you count Sunday, because last Sunday we went to 1:30 a.m.,
1:30 a.m.
And then we had three press conferences after that. The governor started his at 2:30 a.m.
I hope you got some overtime for staying up till Sunday morning.
Yeah, they let me take Thursday and Friday off.
So. Oh, that was nice. Yeah. Okay, but technically, aren't we supposed to only have a 90-day session? How does that work?
Technically, yes. In 2006, Alaska voters voted for a ballot question that made it a state law that the session should last 90 days. But the state law is basically overruled by the state constitution, which says that the session can go to 121 days. And basically what we're seeing is certainly since Governor Walker became governor, there are a lot of disagreements about how the state should be addressing its most serious issues. And that is making it very difficult to get the work done in the allotted 90 days.
And I think a lot of our listeners will remember last year when it seemed like we had so many special sessions. Can you guesstimate how many sessions or how many days they went last year?
It was more than 200. It was the most days that the legislature was in session in any year in the state's history.
Wow.
And they also passed the fewest bills of any year in the state's history.
Wow.
To some extent, they made up for it this year by passing quite a few bills, all in the last 5.5 weeks of the session. There were five bills passed in the first 80 days this year, and to give you a sense of how few that is, last year there were 32 bills passed, and that was the fewest bills in the history of the state. So there were five compared to 32, and they wound up with 113. So there was 108 bills that were passed in the last 37 days. Of the session. I'm sorry for all those numbers. It's tough to give all those numbers on radio, but really dramatic differences there.
So tell me if I got this right. Last year was the longest session ever and the fewest bills ever passed.
Yes, exactly.
Wow. What kind of effect did that have that you observed just on the legislators and the staff going 200 plus days?
Well, I think the toughest thing for the legislators is hearing from their constituents. A lot of people are not happy with it. They're not happy paying per diems, daily payments that legislators receive when the legislature is in session. Last year added up to as much as $51,000 for some legislators. The fewest claimed was $29,000 by former Senator Mike Dunleavy, and the most was about $51,000. And, that adds up to about $2.5 million, about $1.5 million more than the, that's total expense over the course of the year. And that was about 1.5 of the 2.5, was due to, the additional sessions going beyond 90 days.
Got it. So definitely a burden on the taxpayers of our state in
yeah,
a sense.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've got $10 billion budget. So a million, when you're talking $10 billion, is 1/10,000th of the budget. But it's still real money. And you can understand why people are frustrated, particularly with the sense that the state maybe wasn't addressing some of its major issues. Now, arguably, some of that was taken care of this year, and we could talk about
that. Right. I was just going to ask you, was this year a partial reaction to last year?
Yeah. So the tone was a lot more was a lot less combative. That huge number of bills, or large, I shouldn't say huge, but large number of bills that were passed in the last month or so was a sense that gives you a sense that legislators were trying to be more productive. Arguably, the most important bill that was passed this year was Senate Bill 26, which is basically a plan for how the state should draw money from the permanent fund. We've never spent, the state government has never spent money from the permanent fund earnings, and you can't spend money from the protected permanent fund itself. That's why it's permanent. But the state can spend from the earnings account, which is basically the earnings from investments that have grown over time. And we've only spent that money up until this point on permanent fund dividends, and then a very few specific purposes like administering the permanent fund. And this was the first year that they really drew from it for the general government. They knew they had to do that this year because we were out of other savings. And so it was a pretty dramatic step. They didn't want to do that without having passed a law that says, basically lays out a plan for how we're going to do it. And they did do that. They passed a bill that says that the legislature will draw, or the state government will draw 5% of the fund's value, and that'll be about $2.5 to $3 billion a year.
So that was Senate Bill 26, right?
Yes.
I guess it's pretty obvious, but what does that mean to our listeners, people who receive PFDs?
Well, it probably means that it's going to be very difficult to see that full PFD that we haven't seen in 3 years. That when I say full PFD, the permanent fund dividend that's calculated under a formula that's set in state law, and the state hasn't been following that for the last 3 years. And you might say, a listener might say, what, they're not following the law? Are they breaking the law? Basically, the state constitution, going back to the state constitution, that says that the legislature has the power to appropriate money, to spend money. And that power overrules any sort of law that would contradict with that power. And that's what the state Supreme Court ruled in a case that challenged that basically the legislature has that power. Why are they doing it? Because oil prices dropped a few years ago and we don't have the money we used to have. There's still a hole in the budget. This draw from the permanent fund earnings isn't going to be enough to cover all of the gap between what the government's been spending and what it brings in taxes, fees, oil royalties. And so that's still a pretty big challenge, but about arguably three quarters, I mean, depends on how you calculate the size of the problem, but about three quarters of the problem potentially was solved through this. I'll just add one last thing about Senate Bill 26, which is that some people in the legislature say that the bill isn't that meaningful because it doesn't change the state constitution, and therefore the legislature still has this power to spend money how it wants to each year in the future. And that's true, but it will be as meaningful as the legislature treats it in the future. And there are a couple of pretty big incentives they have to follow the law. One is the Permanent Fund Corporation has been calling on a plan like this for many years. And there is a fundamental respect for what the permanent fund does and the role it has in the state. And to threaten that role, to spend more than the fund can afford, to start to draw down the earnings to the point where it starts to threaten the permanent fund, that's a problem. The legislature puts a lot of weight on the view of the Permanent Fund Corporation, but it also puts a lot of weight on the voters who elect our representatives. And I think voters themselves do not want to see the permanent fund be threatened. So the plan, which is basically to spend 5% of the fund's value every year, which looks like it could probably afford to do in the long run, I think there's going to be some very strong incentives for legislators to follow that and to not spend more than that.
I was going to ask you about the future of SB 26. Could it be repealed? What could happen in the future?
Well, they could put something similar into the state constitution that would really lock it in stone. I think unless there's really dramatic changes in the permanent fund's value and in the amount of earnings that it has, like the stock market continues to go up in maybe even a more dramatic way than it has in the last 10 years, or the stock market was to collapse and the value of the fund's investments was to go down a lot. That would have a big impact on the discussions one way or the other. Really, I think the legislature is probably going to want to move on from that argument over how much to take from the earnings and really start to deal with that remaining hole, which will probably still be here next year, depending on what the price of oil is and how much we're getting in oil revenue.
If you're just tuning in, it's a Juneau afternoon, and we're speaking with state government reporter Andrew Kitchenman here in Studio A, getting sort of a recap on the 30th legislature. Okay, so Senate Bill 26 was a big deal this year. What else?
Let's see. The legislature passed a ban on smoking in the workplace, so that affects bars. We had a similar ban in place here in Juneau, but this now affects the entire state. There was a major ethics reform bill that would basically put an end to those per diem payments starting on day 121 if the legislature doesn't pass the operating budget for future sessions. So that's a pretty significant bill. If the governor signs that bill, that would basically kick off the ballot an initiative that was going to be on the ballot this fall that would have accomplished a similar set of ethics reforms.
And when does the governor have to sign that by?
I don't have the date.
Got it. No.
There's also a bill that basically would improve the handling of untested rape kits and basically do an audit of those kits, and that could potentially have some significant impact. And then there are a few other major bills, a bill that had to do with foster care, and as part of the passing the permanent fund bill, they also provided funding for education for the next fiscal year, for the budget after next, and so that provides a little bit of security for schools.
Besides going to ktoo.org and looking for your stories, where's a good way for our listeners to follow some of these bills or get more information on some of these specific bills?
Well, we try to provide that coverage here. The Empire provides coverage. And then you can always go to the legislature's website. It can be a little tricky to navigate, but once you learn how to use the site, there's a lot of information there.
Got it. What's on your radar for next year, Andrew? What could we expect?
Well, like I mentioned, that remaining gap in the state budget, there's a lot of ways the legislature can address it. It can lower PFDs, which I know people don't want to hear. It looks like our PFD this year is going to be 1,600. It's pretty much for sure the governor supports that number, and that's what the legislature passed. But that 1,600 costs $1 billion. The remaining hole in the budget is $700 million, roughly. So they could actually cover the entire gap in the budget if they eliminated three quarters of the PFD. But no one wants that, and I, they would have to face voters after doing that. So there's all the other things that could happen. There could
state
be significant
income
cuts.
Tax. I've heard rumor of
yes.
a state income tax.
Yes, that's definitely a possibility. It was supported by the House majority last year. They did not revisit it this year, but they supported it last year. The governor has proposed different variations on that. On the other hand, the Senate majority at the start of last session, the 2017 legislative session, the Senate majority was supporting $750 million in cuts to state services, which would be pretty dramatic. They like to say that that could be accomplished through reforms or systemic changes in state government, but I think it would be very difficult to reach that level of cut without – probably impossible to reach that level of cut without significantly cutting the services that people receive.
If some of our listeners have input for their legislators, what is the best way to communicate that to them in your experience?
Well, with Senator Egan and Representatives Keto and Parrish, they have websites with you can reach them by email, phone. You can visit their offices in the Capitol. We're going to have a complete turnover here in Juneau in our elected representatives this year because all three are not running for reelection. So we already have a whole bunch of people who are going to be running. They're going to be appearing in public and attending events. And I'm sure they're going to be interested in what everyone has to say, what residents have to say to them.
Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show today. If somebody has a tip for you or a story idea or a question about some of this, what's the best way to get in contact with you?
You can email me at AndrewK, A-N-D-R-E-W-K, at KTOO.org.
Well, it's been great having you on the show today, Andrew Kitchenman. He's a state government reporter for KTOO. He's stationed here in Juneau, but it's a collaboration with Alaska Public Media. Andrew, thanks for coming on the show. Is there anything we're missing, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, just please keep listening. It should be an interesting election year, a governor election. It should be some very competitive races that will have a big impact on the future of Juneau and Alaska.
As we get closer to those, can I invite you back on the show to keep us up to date?
Absolutely. It's been great coming on.
Great. Thanks, Andrew.
This is Bird Note. For such a small owl, the northern saw-whet has a lot to say, and a lot of ways to say it. Male saw-whets weigh about as much as a stack of $7.5 coins, comparable to an American robin, and they send out at least 11 different calls. When agitated or threatened, the saw-whet gives what ornithologists describe as a decidedly uncanny, high-pitched meow. Or a harsh and startlingly loud staccato high-pitched bark. Males give toot, toot, toot advertising calls from late January through May. In part, the rate of calling is determined by the nighttime temperature. There's also a positive correlation between call rate and the amount of old-growth forest near the heart of a bird's territory. And perhaps to keep other saw-whets out of a food-rich territory, males may toot more frequently in years when their favorite prey, white-footed mice and deer mice, are plentiful. So, if the toot-toot-tooting gets monotonous, keep listening. You may hear something truly hair-raising. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Are you ready to launch or grow a Southeast Alaska-based business? The deadline to apply for the 2018 Path to Prosperity Business Development Competition is May 31st.
Don't miss an opportunity to win $25,000 and receive the internationally recognized award-winning support you need to start or grow your business. Visit spruceroot.org for more information and application instructions.
This message is brought to you by Spruce Root Community Development and the Nature Conservancy.
Support comes from The Prospector, featuring Pups at The Prospector, where dogs are welcome to join their owners at The Prospector Bar outdoor seating area. Pups at The Prospector is 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. every Thursday, located downtown on Whittier Street.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, May 22nd, 2018, about 15 minutes till the top of the hour. And I have a bunch of folks in from the Juno STEM Coalition, Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math, to talk about opportunities for kids, adults, teachers, everyone to up their knowledge of science, technology, engineering, and math this summer. We have Becca Sosa from JEDC. She's the STEM Coalition co-chair and also the program manager over at JEDC. Becca, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott.
Nice to have you here. Kevin Shipley, he is the education director at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott.
Nice to have you here. And Sean Isley, the executive director at Discovery Southeast. Sean, welcome.
Thank you.
And Christine Huff, she is a naturalist and coordinator over at Discovery Southeast. Welcome, Christine.
Good afternoon.
It's nice to have you all here. Becca, should we start with you to give us sort of an outline?
Sure. I'll give you a little background. We talked about doing a show and talking about summer opportunities. We kind of came up with the list of camps, and then it quickly snowballed into, well, teachers need to know about this, and community members have these opportunities. So we're just going to see how much we can fit into 15 minutes.
Okay.
And we are lucky that we got some folks here in the office, but I also got great information from Gold Belt Heritage Foundation and from some stuff going on with UAS, too.
And who should be listening and tuning in right now to the show? I mean, because from what it looks like, this is indeed from kids all the way up through adults.
Yep. We have K through...
age of your choice.
There you go.
Okay.
K through K at heart.
Where should we start?
Well, why don't we start with K? I think running through our summer camps is a really great idea. There's some awesome sold-out options that we at least want to mention. I think Discovery Southeast, Sean, you can confirm, totally sold out for the summer?
Yeah, we're working through our wait list. I think there are a couple spots, and we're taking some kids off our wait list. So if parents are interested, it's still worth getting on the wait list at discoverysoutheast.org. But, yeah, we have, I think, almost 30 sessions this summer, and they're almost all full, so we're really excited about it.
And this is Outdoor Explorers, the camp where kids' ages?
It's mostly ages 7 to 12, outdoors every day. That's kind of the hallmark. This year we have a special program for middle schoolers, too. We have a couple weeks of kayaking for the middle schoolers. So it's basically upper elementary and middle schoolers.
And they're all pretty much full, but it's still worth getting on some wait lists, it sounds like.
Yep, discoverysoutheast.org. Go to the program page, and there's a link for Outdoor Explorers, and you can see the wait list. So don't hesitate to sign up there. We do take kids off the wait list every week.
Get your kids studying STEM outside. Okay. And what's going on over at JEDC?
So JEDC, we've got options K-12. We still have room in almost all of our camps. One of the things I'm really excited about is that kindergarten option. We have our first ever kindergarten and first grade camp. It's called Everything Goes Up. It's a half-day camp out at Thunder Mountain High School. And you can kind of gather from the name, there's going to be lots of shooting off rockets and water trickling down from different things. And lots of really fun play. So if I know there aren't as many options for that age group. So if you're looking for something fun for that age, JEDC.org. We also have a version of that camp for grades 2 to 3. And from there, I'll kind of skip. We go up through high school. And one of our new camps this summer for middle school and high school is a 3D printing and design camp. So sometimes folks are looking at that and know, because JEDC is so involved in the robotics program, that it is a robotics camp, and that one is not. It really is just about 3D design and printing. You're going to learn how to use free design software, Tinkercad, and we're going to have at least 5 printers on site. It's out at the NOAA Lab at Ted Stevens. So every one of those kids is going to be working and going home with a tangible printed object every day from camp.
Let's take that one as an example. What's the time like from when to when during the day?
So that camp is from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., just like all of our camps. They get a little break for lunch, and we take breaks throughout the day. There's plenty of social and recreational time mixed in there too. And that one we will have meetup times both downtown and in the valley for carpooling out to Ted Stevens because we know it's quite a trek out there.
And backing up just a little to Everything Goes Up for kindergartners, is that an all-day camp as well?
The kindergartners is not.
Okay.
That one's going to run from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. And is at Thunder Mountain High School.
All right, so I found this list of camps on your website today.
Oh.
Where's the best place?
That jedc.org. You can, if you want to go right there, /summer programs, it's going to take you right to our list.
And these are basically from June, July, and into August?
And into August. Our high school camps are later in the summer, lots of time to sign up for those.
And most of them are week-long, is that right?
Yep, 4 to 5 days. The younger kids, they're 4 days. As we get older, they're full 5-day camps.
Wow. So like that high school camp, that's 1 week of kids working diligently on 3D design and printing.
Yeah. I mean, if you are, I think especially for those artistically minded kids looking for a way to make all those fun thoughts into tangible objects to bring home, great for kids looking to invent. You want a new cell phone holder for your bike, we can help you figure out how to actually make that.
And what's the cost for something like that for a student?
So that camp is $300 for the 5 days. The great news is that financial aid is pretty easy to apply for, and the application is right there on top of that summer programs page.
JEDC.org/summer programs. Thank you, Becca. Kevin Shipley, how do you guys participate in STEM summer activities?
Well, specifically STEM, the main camp we have is our 6th or 8th grade summer math camp, through Opening the Box. And we have 5 partner districts that are in a grant with us, and Juno being one of the 5 partner districts, Klock, Heidelberg, Chatham, and Hoonah. And students come in. We'll have 50 students in this year, 40 overnight campers for 10 days, and 10 or 11 day campers. And we'll be learning canoe building, paddle making, and form line art, kind of integrating math into those programs and having lessons and having a good time.
Very cool. And thinking of our listeners here in Juneau, when are some opportunities that they could join these?
That camp is full, but
okay. Get
on a wait list. People do drop off occasionally, and we'll go from there. Now, the other camps that aren't necessarily STEM-related, we have the Baby Raven Gumboot Camp, July 23rd through 28th. That's a half-day camp. Then go to our website, and information's on there about it. The Latsine Hoop Camp, July 31st through August 3rd. The Latsine Northwest Arts and Leadership Camp, which is July 6th through the 15th, and that is an overnight camp for high school 9th through 12th students, opportunity to get college credit. And all that information is on SeeAlaskaHeritage.org's website, and you're welcome to sign up in all the camps that we have. Our grant sponsors, so they're free.
And I have heard the term STEAM before,
yep.
Right?
Correct.
Which maybe is what these would fall under, the umbrella of science, technology, engineering, arts,
yep.
And mathematics?
Yes.
All right. So, again, those are opportunities at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. The website once more, please, Kevin.
SeaAlaskaHeritage.org. And for your older students, your teachers, we have a culturally responsive education conference coming up August 1st, 2nd, and 3rd for teachers and administrators in the Juneau school districts and school districts in Alaska in general. So it's first come, first serve. We have 150 teaching spots available, and I think I've got 120 already filled. So if you're interested, sign up on the Sea Alaska Heritage website, and we will get you in.
Continuing education, always important for our teachers.
Yes.
All right, Sean Isley switching over here, or Christine, Discovery Southeast. We talked a little bit about middle school and elementary camps, but you have stuff for teachers as well, right?
Yeah, more of that professional education. So we're pretty excited to offer a new course, Juno Nature Seminars, and these are weekend courses. They provide professional development for teachers so they can get continuing education credit through the University of Alaska, but they're also open to the community at large. So if you just want to explore and learn more about Juno natural history, this is a great course to take.
Christine, can you outline what one of those looks like for our listeners?
Well, for the teachers, there is 2 evening classes, a Thursday and a Friday for a couple hours, and then the Saturday and Sunday, there's about 6 hours each of those days, and the community is welcome to come to the Sunday ones. It's going to be all outdoors on the Saturdays and Sundays, so come dressed in boots and raincoats and things. And they'll be led by our naturalist, Steve Murley and Richard Karstensen, who are pretty well-known naturalists here in the Juneau area.
Absolutely. If people want more information about these opportunities, where should they go?
the discoverysoutheast.org.
Okay. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, and, you know, I was just talking to Richard today, and it's Saturday and Sunday that's both for teachers and the community. And Richard said that really the community is encouraged to come to the early ones if they want to. So I think those are Thursday and Friday courses that are open to community as well as just the teachers.
And where are those likely to occur?
They're going to be in a classroom at the University of Alaska Southeast for the classroom time. And then the actual outdoors times are going to be at the Glacier and at, what was the other place?
Outer Point.
Outer Point, yeah.
So it's kind of cool because you take the wetlands and you kind of think of it from either side. You've got this big glacial valley coming down, and then Outer Point is kind of the other side of that. So we see them on the road system as two very different places, but geologically they're kind of looking at the same place from different angles.
Okay. And all of this, Becca, falls under the Juno STEM Coalition.
Yes.
Right.
And do we have time to give a couple more?
We have about a minute and a half left.
Oh, boy. Well, then I had conversations with a lot of community organizations coming into this. If you're looking for things, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, find them on Facebook, find their webpage. They have middle school and high school camps that still have space with lots of awesome STEM and arts culture integration. They also are collaborating with UAS, Tlingit and Haida, and some other groups on the One Canoe Gathering, which has opportunities for both kids, teachers, community members to join that. And that you can find, if you actually just Google One Canoe and UAS, it comes up as your top choice. I think that's the fastest way to find it.
Great. And if people want to learn more about the STEM Coalition, which helps sort of network all of these together, I guess?
Yeah, junostem.org. And we are working on making sure our calendar has all of these activities updated on it. So if you just want to one-stop shopping, junostem.org.
Okay, check it out. That's Becca Sosa of JEDC and the STEM Coalition. We also spoke with Kevin Shipley of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, Sean Isley, and Christine Huff of Discovery Southeast. Thank you all so much for coming on the show. The website to find all of these educational opportunities for everybody. Once more?
JunoSTEM.org.
All right, thanks everybody for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Joe Davis Fleming, and I am the Executive Director for the Juno Symphony. Join us on May 25th at 6 p.m. at Elizabeth Perachevich Hall for Shaken, Not Stirred, an evening with live music, a silent and outcry auction, delicious food, and, of course, cocktails, Shaken, Not Stirred. All proceeds benefit the Juno Symphony. Get your tickets at the Jack Hartside Books or online at junosymphony.org.
Thank you for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Shelley Delaney will be your host tomorrow, and we'll meet hiking book author Molly Foster. We'll learn about the run for public media and radio, the only fools run at midnight. And the Grateful Dogs will be here to tell us about their annual cleanup. Those interviews, bird note, music and more right here on a Juno Afternoon. It's currently 53 degrees here in the capital city. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon.